welcome, either good morning or good afternoon, depending on your time zone, to today's Clue-In Internet Seminar, which is covering OSC readiness as they present RCRA for OSCs. This session has been sponsored by the U.S. EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. My name is Jean Balance, and I come from the same program office here at the EPA, and I'll be helping to serve as the online moderator for today's session. Our instructor will be Dave Phillips from Tetra Tech, and again, before I turn things over to Dave to begin the formal presentation, I want to cover a few housekeeping and reminder items. As I mentioned, for those of you who are joining us for the first time on a Clue-In seminar, each Clue-In Internet participant is expected to manually move through the materials at verbal cues and instructions from our presenters. So if you haven't done so already, everyone should have a copy of the PowerPoint materials available either on their computer in a web browser window or downloaded as PowerPoint or PDF. You can access the slides from the seminar homepage, which you would have seen after successfully registering. You can click the button that says Go to Seminar to allow the slides to load online, or you can actually download a copy of the materials as either PowerPoint or PDF. So everyone should be looking at slide number one, and again, each participant will manually move through the materials at verbal cues from the instructors. At this point, I'll ask everybody to turn the page on to slide number two. For those of you on the phone lines, we do ask you keep your phones on mute. You can use *6 to mute your line and #6 to unmute your line when we get to questions with our instructors. Until we get to the question period of today's session, we do ask again to keep your phone muted. Do not put the call on hold. There could be background music or commercials that will be disruptive. So please go ahead and take a moment if you haven't done so already and mute your line by hitting *6. Again, we will have a portion of the session where you can actually ask questions and interact with our presenters live. At that time, we'll remind you how you can take your phones off of mute. If you're streaming the audio online, you won't be able to actually ask a question out loud, but instead what you'll have to do is type a question up. For those of you that are looking at the slides in a web browser window, you'll see a series of orange icons that appear along the top of your slides. The icons with the arrows will actually help you to move through the materials, so you can actually click the single arrow pointing to the right to move forward one slide, the single arrow pointing to the left to move you backwards one slide. You can also use the numbered links that appear on the side to jump to the appropriate slide as our instructor announces their movement through the materials. Another thing you want to be sure to do is turn off any pop-up blockers, and those of you streaming the audio online can actually click the question mark icon. A new window will open up, which will allow you to actually type up a question or comment that I will then read out loud to the instructor on your behalf when we get to the appropriate break for Q&A. Again, you don't have to wait to Q&A to actually type up those questions. We would encourage you to type them up as soon as they occur to you, and then we'll keep them in the queue until we get to the points for questions and answers. You can also use that same question mark icon to report any technical difficulties you may be having. Just be sure to include a telephone number if you're having any problems so that our support staff can actually call you to help troubleshoot the issue. Final reminder that today's session is being recorded, and in about 2 weeks, you will automatically receive an email from me, which will provide you with the link to actually download or replay the session. If you want to, you can certainly go to the Clue-In Archives page right now and access the almost 400 previously recorded sessions that we have available for free, or you can even choose to subscribe to a free podcast, so you can have the latest training recording delivered directly to you as soon as it's available. So it sounds like everybody on the line is muted, and I appreciate that and thank you in advance for your cooperation. And those are all the housekeeping or instructions that I have to provide. So with that, I'm going to direct everyone to move on to slide number three, and I'm going to turn things over to Dave Phillips from Tetra Tech. And again, if you're on the phones, we would ask that you mute your line. So if you're on the phones, it's *6 to mute.
Okay. Thanks, Jean.
Thank you very much.
This is Dave Phillips of Tetra Tech. I'm going to be your instructor for the next 2 hours. Just a little brief background. My background's in chemical engineering. I've been working in the RCRA Superfund programs for the past 25 years. I do a lot of teaching for EPA, and I've presented this course with Paul Perrinard a number of times at OSC Readiness, and as part of it's actually derived from our waste transportation treatment and disposal class as well. So you might have seen that on TrainX or some of the other information out there on available trainings for you. In the next 2 hours, we're going to try to condense what is normally a four-hour course at OSC Readiness to highlight some of the important things OSC should know about the Resource Conservation Recovery Act and their implementing regulations with respect to managing hazardous waste properly during removal actions. And we have four modules we'll go through The first one is just a brief overview of the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, and then our second module will focus on hazardous waste determination. That is, what is a hazardous waste and what's not a hazardous waste? Obviously, that's the most critical area because upon determining whether something's a hazardous waste, then you're obligated to manage it appropriately. And once we make clear what is a hazardous waste, or make somewhat clear what is a hazardous waste and what is not, we'll talk a little bit about some of the management regulations that come into play, both on-site and off-site. And the most important, or I guess one of the more important ones, is the land disposal restrictions. So that's the subject of Module 3. And then Module 4 will briefly talk about other means of managing RCRA waste on-site and off-site. So with that, let's go ahead and get started. It's 1 o'clock here in East Coast. Hopefully, because it's a RCRA class, you do have some caffeine available, whatever beverage of choice is usually necessary. And one quick update for you sports fans out there, if you're following the Women's World Cup, the U.S. is leading France 1-0 at halftime. So let's start with the RCRA overview and why RCRA requirements are important to OSC. So go to the next slide, I believe slide 4. RCRA is important because it's obviously it defines what's a hazardous waste versus a non-hazardous waste. And for those things that are hazardous waste, RCRA will establish a system of requirements. We refer to it as cradle to grave, but basically management requirements from the point the waste is generated to ultimately when it's disposed of. And these serve as ARARs at sites, at Superfund sites. When hazardous waste are sent off-site, RCRA establishes applicable requirements such as the use of manifests, sending the waste to a permitted treatment, storage, and disposal facility. So there are numerous applicable requirements that kick into play, again, for those materials that are defined as hazardous waste. But most importantly, too, understanding RCRA is important with respect to your strategy and identifying the costs for managing waste that you generate during removal actions. They can significantly affect the overall cost of removal actions because in many cases, the off-site treatment disposal costs for hazardous waste are a large component of the overall cost of removal actions. So that's why, in a nutshell, why they're important to you. Flipping to the next slide, let's just go over quickly what RCRA, a little history on RCRA. It was enacted in 1976 by Congress to deal with national problems associated with improper management of solid hazardous waste. And it established a number of different goals to protect human health and environment from hazards posed by improper waste disposal. And then there were other additional goals dealing with conserving natural resources and energy, reducing the amount of waste, and ultimately to ensure that waste are properly managed so they don't become, the sites that manage them don't become Superfund sites, which was passed, enacted in 1980 as a counterpart to RCRA because of all the problems associated with past improper disposal of waste. Turning to the next slide, this is just a brief statutory framework of RCRA. RCRA actually amended the existing Solid Waste Disposal Act, which was enacted in the mid-1960s. Since RCRA has been enacted, there have been several major amendments. The most important one is the Hazardous and Solid Waste Amendments of 1984 that created the Land Disposal Restrictions Program and significant other requirements that are embodied into the RCRA program now. If we look at the RCRA law, it actually creates three major regulatory programs administered by EPA and authorized states. The Solid Waste Program, which is established under Subtitle D of the Resource Conservation Recovery Act. The Hazardous Waste Program, which is the focus of this seminar, which was established under Subtitle C of RCRA, and that's why you'll hear RCRA sometimes. We refer to Subtitle C of RCRA when we're talking about hazardous waste, or Subtitle D for the solid waste. In addition, the Hazardous and Solid Waste Amendments created the Underground Storage Tank Program, which was added by Subtitle I of RCRA, and that addressed leaking underground storage tanks at gasoline stations and other entities that managed products in such underground storage tanks. Turning to the next slide, we'll look at the implementing regulations for the hazardous waste authorities under RCRA. Subtitle C authorized the EPA to establish regulations to implement the statutory goals and authorities created by RCRA. And these initially focused, the original RCRA focused on waste identification. The initial implementing regulations came out in 1980. And they focused on hazardous waste identification, hazardous and proper hazardous waste management. The 1984 amendments, in addition, one of the critical things that they did change to the structure of RCRA is they established the RCRA Corrective Action or Cleanup Program, which is applicable to treatment, storage, and disposal facilities. Those facilities that have permits or were operated under what we call interim status under RCRA. And so the big change that occurred is the original RCRA program was envisioned as a prevention program to ensure safe, proper identification and safe management of waste, but RCRA also has cleanup authorities and a remedial program as created by their, as established by their corrective action authorities that are often used at RCRA-regulated facilities. Now, the federal regulations are set forth in Title 40 Code of Federal Regulations, Part 260 through 279. And we'll be referring to the federal regulations throughout. However, if you flip to the next slide, you'll see that the RCRA program is delegated by EPA to states and currently are 48 states that are authorized for the base program and various elements of other additional elements of the RCRA program. The only two states, I believe, that are currently not authorized are Iowa and Alaska. I think Alaska turned back their program a couple of years ago. So those are being implemented by the EPA, their respective EPA regions. So it typically, what this means is, though I'm going to be referring to the federal regulations, oftentimes because you'll be working in states that are authorized, and the states will have their own RCRA regulations, which they have established. Sometimes we'll just reference, incorporate by reference, or refer to the federal regulations. Some states will actually codify their regulations differently. But you will refer to the state regulations, but they, in general, mimic the federal requirements. Some state regulations, however, one thing to caution you is some state laws and regulations under the hazardous waste programs may be more stringent or broader in scope than the federal program. Those of you who work in Region 9 and do work in California will know that. California identifies a number of wastes as hazardous that are not defined as hazardous by the federal government. Some states also have a more stringent standards with respect to their management of hazardous wastes than the federal programs. So that's a brief background on the overview of RCRA and the statutory and regulatory framework established for it. Again, the states are the primary implementers of the RCRA program, and it's their regulations you consult and comply with respect to the removal actions that you're undertaking in those authorized states. So now we'll move ahead to Module 2, which is hazardous waste determination. And obviously, this is the most critical aspect of implementing and interpreting the applicability, I should say, of RCRA requirements to the management of waste that you generate at removal actions. So let's turn to the next slide here. I got my start, before I get into this, I got my start working many years ago on something called the RCRA Superfund Hotline. And we would, I always tell the story, but we would receive about 300,000 questions a year at the hotline, and about 60% of these questions were, I have something, is it a hazardous waste or not? So this is clearly the most critical aspect of determining and applicability of RCRA requirements And it obviously should be the focus of a significant amount of effort to get it right. What we've learned over those years is that there's some basic information you need to have at your disposal before you consult the regulations in determining whether something's a hazardous waste or not. And so I'm going to go through that in this slide here. But as the slide indicates to you, it's an issue that you generally are always going to encounter during a Superfund response, be it removal or remedial. Obviously, the hazardous waste determination is a prerequisite for RCRA applicability. The regulations establish a four-step process, which we'll walk through in the next couple of slides. But before we get to those regulatory, those regulations and the process that we'll go through, you should answer three questions first about any material in order to determine whether it's a RCRA hazardous waste or not. And these questions are fairly obvious, but they're really important because they can affect how how you make that determination. The first one is, what is it, obviously? The second one is, how was it produced, or where did it come from? Okay. And the third question you have to answer is, what am I going to do with it? Okay. All three of those questions should be answered, or you should have options or some knowledge of that, because as we step through the regulations, if what you're going to do with it or how it was produced changes, that can significantly affect whether the waste is hazardous or not. And we'll give you a couple of examples to show you that when we walk through the slides in a few minutes. But one of the most key things I can leave you guys with in this seminar is that if you're trying to determine whether something's a hazardous waste or not, answer these three questions and have, you know, what is it, how is it produced, and what am I going to do with it? That will go a long way to, you know, reducing the different variables and being able to properly interpret whether something's a hazardous waste or not according to the implementing regulations EPA has established. The final thing I want to caution you with is RCRA, like all regulatory programs or environmental statutes, has its own set of terms or special terms defined by Congress and EPA in the implementing regulations and in Congress case in the statute. Particularly in the implementing regulations, RCRA has established a glossary or definite dictionary, if you will, but the regulations define a number of terms in 40 CFR 260.10, and they're also defined elsewhere in specific other sections of the implementing regulations. You really need to be aware that these terms have special meanings and are specifically defined under RCRA. For example, one is sludge. A sludge has a defined meaning under RCRA as a waste that's produced or generated from a pollution control device. You'll also hear other terms, which we'll refer to later in this, in this seminar, like spent materials or use constituting disposal or reclaimed. These all have specific meanings under RCRA, and so. Like spent material means a material that's been used and contaminated through use such that can no longer be used for its intended purpose. It's important that you understand that because you'll see a reference in the regulations to whether spent materials are solid waste or not. And so these terms, I just need to make you aware, have specific definitions and meanings. And it goes a long way to properly interpreting the applicability of RCRA regulations by understanding the importance of these definitions or special terms. Let's go to the next slide. And as I mentioned earlier, I talked about the process, the regulatory process or four steps that are used to identify whether something's a hazardous waste. Well, here they are in a nutshell. Basically, the process is once you know what it is, what your material is, how it was produced, and what you're going to do with it, you first determine, has EPA or Congress excluded that material from the definition of solid waste? If you determine that it's not been excluded, then you seek to see if the material meets the RCRA regulatory definition of solid waste. If it does meet the definition of solid waste, then the next step is, okay, has it been excluded by Congress or EPA from the definition of hazardous waste? If not, then you see if the solid waste meets the definition of a hazardous waste under RCRA. So as you can see that through this process, in order for something to be a hazardous waste under RCRA, from a regulatory standpoint, it must first meet the regulatory definition of a solid waste. So hazardous wastes are, in fact, a subset of the regulatory definition of solid waste. And the vast majority of solid waste is not defined federally as hazardous waste by the regulations, believe it or not. Most solid waste is subject to state subtitle D programs, or there's numerous waste streams from large industrial operations such as mining, mineral processing, coal ash. Well, that's under, there's a regulatory effort to revise that, but that have been excluded. And so you have to be aware that there's a lot of solid waste that has been, while it is harmful to human health and the environment, if improperly managed, it has been excluded from the definition of hazardous waste for one reason or another. That final bullet there refers to variants and rulemaking petitions, and this is just an option created under the RCRA program for anybody who produces a waste, which we refer to as a generator, or industries that produce waste, to seek a variance or from the definition of hazardous waste through a delisting process, or in some cases actually seek an exclusion from the definition of a solid waste based on how they're recycling or reusing a material. So these are options that are available. They are rarely used during removal actions. They've been used in Superfund remedial actions, the delisting process has been used once or twice, I've seen, in records of decision, where they're we're trying to attempt to remove a large volume of low-risk waste from RCRA regulatory controls. But typically, again, these variances and rulemaking petitions are not used during removal actions because of the time, the amount of time it takes and to get it, and also the cost benefits in most cases. Flipping to the next slide, let's just briefly look at the exclusions from the definition of solid waste. Congress and EPA, Congress through the statute, directed EPA initially to exclude certain materials from regulation by not defining them as solid waste. A list of these materials are found in 261.4A. That's where the regulatory definitions are. And some examples of these things would include things like point source discharges that are regulated under the Clean Water Act. So that would only apply to actually the wastewater that's been treated and is being discharged at the point that it's being monitored. There are other materials such as septic waste, domestic sewage, that because they are being managed or regulated under other programs, again, the Clean Water Act, state programs, that EPA or Congress and EPA through the regulations have excluded those materials as solid waste. It's a rather limited number of materials excluded from the definition of solid waste. One thing I would again caution you is that the scope of these exclusions sometimes can be a little bit tricky, and the one paragraph that may be dedicated to explaining that in the CFR may have reams of interpretive memorandum that EPA has generated for site-specific situations to interpret those exclusions. So be aware of those. Moving to the next slide, let's spend a little more time on those materials that are not excluded, but how do we determine whether they meet the definition of solid waste, the regulatory definition? And this is established in 40 CFR 261.2. The regulations actually define solid waste as discarded materials. And then the regulations further define discarded to mean materials that are, quote, abandoned or recycled in certain ways, considered inherently waste-like or meet the EPA's definition of a military munition that's going to be discarded. Let's look at some examples and further examine how you interpret this discarded definition. Abandoned simply means your intent is to throw it away, or that you're accumulating it with the intent to throw away, or that somebody has abandoned it to begin with. Say, buried drums that you're removing from a landfill, okay, or a trench. So abandoned's pretty straightforward. Recycled in certain ways is much more complicated, and this is where we won't have time to go into this in depth here. We could spend easily a day talking about when materials are regulated as solid waste under RCRA based on how they're recycled. But what's critical for you to know here is in order to determine whether something, if it's going to be recycled, remains a waste under the RCRA program, you really do have to know what it is, how it was produced, and what you're going to do with it. EPA has defined certain what they call secondary materials, and this is where we refer to things such as spent materials, sludges, byproducts, and commercial chemical products. And secondary materials that meet these definitions will, in some cases, remain a solid waste depending on how they're recycled. In some cases, they may not be a solid waste. There's a table, Table 1 in 40 CFR 261.2, which lays out which secondary materials, depending on the means in which they're recycled, are they being used in a manner constituting disposal? Are they being reclaimed? Are they being used for energy? Purpose being burned for energy. This table one will identify when those secondary materials are solid waste or when they are not. In addition, EPA has crafted special definitions for things like scrap metal, for example, where if you meet these definitions and it's being recycled, it may be a solid waste, but it can't be a hazardous waste. It will be excluded from definition of hazardous waste. Or in some cases, it may not be defined as a solid waste because it's always recycled in a proper manner, and therefore there's no inherent threat to the environment, and the EPA has chosen not to regulate it. With respect to certain materials, if it can be reused for its intended purpose without being reclaimed, or can be reused instead of buying a virgin material, and it's, again, not going to be reclaimed prior to its reuse, or it's not going to be applied to the ground, then such materials will not meet the definition of solid waste. An example would be where you're doing a cleanup at a plating facility, and they have a drum of a degreaser, which has never been used. It's a virgin product. And you can find somebody who can take it, use it as is for a legitimate purpose without reclaiming it or not. In such a case, that type of material under the regulations would not be considered a solid waste. I have to reiterate this, but this is the trickiest and probably the most complex part. It is the most complex part of the definition of solid waste. Suffice it to say that if you're going to recycle a material, or you have an option or an opportunity to recycle a material at your removal actions, some sort of material that you generate, you'll have to work through the 40 CFR 261.2 regulations in an effort to determine whether or not it remains a solid waste based on what the material is and how it's being recycled, or whether it's been excluded by EPA from the definition of solid waste as a result. Discarded also refers to something called inherently waste-like. This is a very, very small subset of basically pesticide, waste from pesticide manufacturing. They're really unique to that industry, that EPA in the mid-1980s made a regulatory determination that no matter how these things would be recycled, they're always going to remain a solid waste. And then with respect to military munitions, this came about in 1997. It was an effort on the part of EPA and the Department of Defense to define which military munitions, would no longer, that are no longer part of the arsenal or part of the military's need, meet the definition of a solid waste. And these might be things that you encounter if you're doing like a range cleanup action or something like that, or at a formerly used defense site where you might encounter military munitions. Okay, moving to the next slide, let's look at the exclusions from the definition of hazardous waste. Now, at this point in the process, let's assume that what we have is something that meets, our material meets the definition of a solid waste. So now we're looking to see is it going to meet the definition of hazardous waste? Again, Congress and EPA, Congress in the statute, identified a large group of waste, solid waste, which they excluded from the definition of hazardous waste under RCRA, pending an EPA study of these wastes and a regulatory determination whether these wastes should be regulated as hazardous waste or not. EPA spent 20 years going through this list. These include mining wastes, waste from the exploration of oil, natural gas. There's a number of different ones there. And the agency has made regulatory determinations associated with these exclusions to identify the scope of the exclusion. That is, which waste streams remain excluded from the definition of hazardous waste, which ones are not, which ones should be identified as hazardous waste. This is all found specifically in the regulations in 40 CFR 261.4B, as in boy, that's where you would look. And if you have a site that has like tailings, for example, from mining operations, or you're dealing with a smelter and you have all the different types of waste that might be associated with a smelter, this is where understanding the scope of these exclusions is extremely important, okay, because you can have material, you can have tailings, or you can have dross or other types of materials at a smelter, which might exhibit what we call the RCRA characteristic of toxicity, which I'll get to a little bit later. But in fact, if they meet the definition of in EPA's regulatory determinations of an excluded material, okay, or then they're, even though they would exhibit this characteristic of toxicity, the waste is excluded from the definition of solid waste by virtue of the scope of one of these exclusions that EPA has established for mining, mineral processing, beneficiation wastes. So, again, we could spend, EPA has had day-long courses for some of these exclusions to explain the nuts and bolts and the scope of these regulatory determinations and exclusions that they've crafted. Obviously, I don't have the time to go into those there. I just want you to make you aware that if you're dealing with certain types of waste that might fall into these exclusions, you'll read 40 CFR 261.4B. There may be one, two, maybe five, 10 paragraphs on it, but understand there's potentially a background document and just, a large volume of site-specific or, nationwide interpretive memos that EPA headquarters and some of the regions have generated, produced, that help explain the nature and scope of these exclusions. So just be aware of that. Okay, going to the next slide, then, the definition of hazardous waste, 40 CFR 261.3. At this point, let's assume that our solid waste does not fit into any of those exclusions we just talked about. So now, how do you determine if the solid waste is a hazardous waste? And this gets into the classic question is it a listed hazardous waste, okay, by EPA? If not, does it exhibit any of the characteristics of hazardous waste? And then there's two corollary rules that go along with that, which we refer to as the mixture rule and derived from rule. Let's look at first, if we turn to the next slide, let's look at what we're talking about with listed hazardous wastes. EPA has identified three categories of listed hazardous wastes. Under the RCRA statute, EPA was given two primary authorities to defining when a solid waste can become a hazardous waste. The first one is they could go out, study a waste stream, and through a rulemaking, list it as a hazardous waste. And so that's what we're referring to here. It's called listed hazardous waste simply because EPA studied these wastes, and through a rulemaking, they've actually identified them and described them and placed them into regulations, so they're listed. And these include, as I mentioned, three categories: waste from nonspecific sources, which are prefixed by an F code, and this would be like F001, F032, F006. Listed waste from specific sources, these are waste streams that are associated with very specific industrial operations, petroleum, refinery, steel manufacturing, wood preserving, painting. So they're waste streams that EPA studied, that they've listed through studying industrial operations, and through the rulemaking they specifically listed them, and they're prefixed by the K code. And then there's a third category, which refers to commercial chemical products that are discarded. And these are the ones that are identified in 261.33, and they're given either a P code or a U code. The P code simply denotes that they're considered acutely hazardous. And we'll talk more about acutely hazardous a little bit later, but if you're a generator or somebody who produces this waste, if you produce an acutely hazardous waste, it becomes subject to full RCRA regulation if you produce more than 2.2 pounds of that acutely hazardous waste in a calendar month, or 1 kilogram. Whereas if it's not an acute hazardous waste, typically to be regulated, you have to, for that waste to be regulated under RCRA, you have to generate at least 100 kilograms or 220 pounds per calendar month. Discarded commercial chemical products, you might run into that situation again where you're doing, if you've done cleanups or removal actions, say at schools or laboratories where they have stock chemicals that haven't been used, and you're going to dispose of them. They might meet the definition of a discarded commercial chemical product. The other case where that might come into play is if somebody had a tank, or again, if they had a container of a commercial chemical product and it leaked. There was a rupture to it, or the tank leaked, or the piping associated with it leaked, and then you clean up debris, soil, other materials that have been contaminated with that commercial chemical product. There's a regulation in 261.33D, as in David, I believe, that says that any of the spill residue associated with a spill or release of a discarded commercial chemical product, listed commercial chemical product, is regulated as the listed commercial chemical product. So just make that aware to you. You might encounter that occasionally. So those are your listed hazardous wastes. Again, the important thing to note from a listed hazardous waste is knowing what the material is, and it's very important to understand how that was produced, because in the EPA's descriptions of listed hazardous waste, they'll talk about what produced it in addition to what it is. So that's an important thing for you to remember. Flipping to the next slide, the major thing you should be aware about in terms of the difference between listed and characteristic hazardous waste is, as I mentioned earlier, listed wastes have been identified through a study and a rulemaking that EPA has done, which resulted in the waste stream being placed into the regulations. If the description of the waste stream meets the description in the regulations that EPA's identified regulations, then it's a hazardous waste. There's no testing required or sampling whatsoever. So that's the idea or the concept behind a listed hazardous waste. You know what it is. You know how it's produced. You see if it meets the description the EPA has. Boom, it does. It's a hazardous waste. Now, characteristic waste, which we'll talk about in the next slide, is where EPA's authority to identify a hazardous waste was based on them identifying a property, a unique property, which could they could identify a test to measure that property, and based on a waste having that or exhibiting that property, it would be regulated as a hazardous waste. So the characteristic has the determination whether something's a characteristic hazardous waste will rely in part on testing, or you can use your knowledge, professional judgment, whether something would exhibit this characteristic. But that's different than the determination of whether something's a listed hazardous waste. So hopefully I made myself clear to you on that. Now, in the Superfund world, as you guys well know, you come to sites and you don't know how the stuff got there, what it is. You may not have records, you may not have access to information, and you know, stuff's been abandoned and spilled and improperly managed. It's kind of like my 6 and 8 year old's bedrooms, okay? Just, you know, it's a disaster trying to figure out what you need a forensic scientist to figure out what the heck went on in there. What EPA stated way back in 1990 is that, listen, if you don't know it's listed and you don't have the information to make that determination that's listed, you don't have to assume it meets the definition of a listed hazardous waste. So you're given some latitude there. And so in those cases where you don't know how the you know what the material is, but you don't know how it was produced, then you don't have to assume that it meets one of the listings. So you might run to a site and you have something that's there's a mixture and it has a little bit of toluene in it. And you sit there and you go, oh, okay, I know toluene's on the U list, and I know that there's some F waste streams, listed F streams that also include toluene. Well, just because the waste has toluene, but you don't know how the toluene got in there, and you really can't make that determination, you don't have to assume that it's a listed hazardous waste. You simply need to determine whether it exhibits a characteristic, as we'll talk about in a few seconds, in order to make that determination whether it's hazardous under RCRA or not. So hopefully that makes some sense to you. That's an important policy decision. And again, it gives you a lot of latitude and also provides the fact that, you know, there's an assumption that not everything out there is a listed hazardous waste simply because it may have chemicals that have been that are included in other waste streams that have been listed. Okay, next slide is characteristics of hazardous waste. And as I mentioned before, the statute gave EPA the authority to identify properties of waste streams that if they could measure them, they would provide a means of determining whether or not they were hazardous and therefore subject to regulation and should be regulated. EPA has identified four characteristics: their ignitability, corrosivity, reactivity, and toxicity. They originally had identified a radioactive and a biological. They had proposed those two properties as characteristics, but they never actually finalized regulations for those two characteristics. But the specific definition of ignitability, corrosivity, reactivity, toxicity is in the regulations that are shown in your slide. Ignitability, really you're looking at some of the properties you're looking at are the flash point, which is the vapor that exists over a liquid, at what point it will ignite. With corrosivity, one of the properties obviously you're looking at is pH. If there is a pH, if the waste stream has pH potential, so you're examining whether it's on the extreme ends of the spectrum of the pH scale as to whether or not it's going to be hazardous. And this is one where it's unique. I'll mention real quickly with the corrosivity definition. Federal regulation only defines waste as corrosive if they are liquid, aqueous, or they're liquids. Some states have gone more stringent, and they will actually identify certain solid, physically solid materials that are wastes, okay, as corrosive as well. So be aware of that. Reactivity is probably the most subjective of the characteristics of hazardous waste, because their EPA has not established a test that it's in the regulations for determining whether something is reactive or not. So a lot of it relies on the generator's knowledge of the material, of the waste, in order to determine whether it's reactive or not. And then toxicity is the final characteristic. The test method used here is the toxicity characteristic leaching procedure, or TCLP, which is used to determine that. And there's really the idea behind the toxicity characteristic was to evaluate waste streams for various heavy metals and organic chemicals to determine whether they would leach those chemicals in amounts that would pose a threat to drinking water supplies if they were. And the idea would be if they posed a threat, if they leached the chemicals above a regulatory threshold, then the idea was such waste had to go to a hazardous waste landfill instead of a municipal waste landfill. So that's the basis behind the toxicity characteristic. The other two corollary rules to the definition of hazardous waste, which I mentioned earlier, was the mixture and derived from oils. These are still in effect. They were established back in 1980-81 when EPA first issued the regulations for identification of hazardous wastes. Basically, the idea behind this is simple. Where you have mixtures of listed hazardous wastes and wastes that are not listed or solid waste, the agency, the regulations will assume that the mixture is a listed, has to be managed as a listed hazardous waste. If you have a mixture of characteristic wastes and solid waste, then that mixture will only be regulated if it continues to exhibit the characteristics of hazardous waste. The derived from rule is similar in that if you have a process which a hazardous waste goes into and then a waste stream is produced from that, derived from it, if it was a listed hazardous waste that went into the process and a new waste was derived from it, then the rule says that the new waste is going to be considered a listed hazardous waste because it was derived from a prior listed hazardous waste. Whereas if you have a characteristic waste going into the process and a new waste is generated from that process, it will only be considered a hazardous waste if it continues to exhibit any of the characteristics. So that's the short story behind the hazardous waste mixture and derived from rules. Again, these have been subject to, they have a long legal history, a long battleground in the courts, and there's a lot of policy interpretive memorandum regarding the interpretation of mixture and derived from rules to cite specific cases. But just be aware that those come into play if you deal with mixtures or streams where you can identify waste has been derived from some other process where that held a waste or there was waste input into that process. Okay, the final slide, I believe, that we have on our definition of hazardous waste is actually not part of the regulations, but it's what we refer to as the contained-in policy. This was established by EPA as a policy in the mid-1980s, around 1985-86. This came about with the Superfund cleanups and the advent of the RCRA Corrective Action Program, and specifically, it was the agency's policy. They established this policy to address contaminated environmental media, specifically contaminated soils, contaminated sediments, contaminated groundwater. And it is, even though it's not a regulation, you won't see a regulation in 261.3 or wherever that defines this containing policy. It is considered an ARAR under Superfund. EPA has established this. And in situations where you have contaminated environmental media, so you have soil that may have organic chemicals in it, you know the source of it. Okay, for example, say you had a tank which held a spent hazardous waste solvent, like spent TCE. It leaked. And so you're cleaning up this underground storage tank, and you're cleaning up the surrounding soil or backfill materials with the tank that's also contaminated with TCE. You're excavating it, removing it. The containing policy would indicate that that contaminated environmental media and backfill associated with that leaking tank needs to be managed as a hazardous waste, as long as it contains a sufficient amount of TCE that warrants that. The question becomes, the $64,000 question becomes, well, how much TCE is it or not? While the federal government or EPA hasn't established detailed criteria for what's in or what's out under this containment policy, most states have a policy or guidance that helps you determine when contaminated environmental media needs to be managed as a hazardous waste. Because it contains a listed hazardous waste, which was the scenario I gave you earlier where it involved a spent listed hazardous waste solvent in a tank that leaked and contaminated the backfill and surrounding soil. If your source of contamination was not a listed hazardous waste, so the contaminated media, say, has chemicals in it and may have heavy metals in it, but you know that the source was not listed, then the media would only be considered hazardous or need to be managed as hazardous waste if it exhibits a characteristic of a hazardous waste. Again, this goes back to that, you know, the fundamental concept I talked about at the beginning of this module, which is you need to know what the material is, how it was, and how it was produced. In this case, that's really important in terms of the application of the containment policy. Again, the containment policy is done on a site-by-site or case-by-case basis. Check with the states that you're in, because, again, the states, a number of states have issued detailed guidance which helps clarify that containment policy with respect to the management of contaminated environmental media in their states. Moving to the next slide, it's just, again, a brief discussion on variances and petitions. I talked about delisting earlier. The second bullet I'd like to talk about a little bit more, but that's a contained out determination. If you have a situation where contaminated media, the state tells you that the contaminated media contains a listed hazardous waste, then you'll have to consult their guidance or rules, if they actually have rules, but I don't – most of my situations that I've encountered is guidance that the state has issued. They will have levels that they've established of chemicals and metals which are used to do the contained out determination. And so you would just simply need to consult their guidance in order to make that case. Finally, I think we have a couple of other things here. It's just an alternative regulatory program. There are certain hazardous wastes out there that EPA has established a alternative regulatory program, which is more flexible and less rigorous and less stringent in terms of your obligations for managing those wastes. And they're known as, we call this the Universal Waste Program. The federal regulations are in 40 CFR Part 273, and the universal wastes that have been identified so far are batteries, pesticides, mercury-containing equipment, and lamps, fluorescent lamps. Some states have additional waste streams, which they identify under the universal waste programs. For example, aerosol cans is a common one that you'll see. Some wastes have e-waste. As well, that they electronic wastes that they've identified under their universal waste program. If you're dealing at sites where you have buildings or other things like that, where you're encountering, say, large amounts of lamps or mercury-containing equipment, the universal waste standards allow you more flexibility. They're not nearly as complicated and rigorous as the regular RCRA requirements for hazardous waste. And so they avail you an alternative regulatory program that's easier to manage those types of wastes. Okay, I have some examples here. We're halfway through the seminar, so I'm just going to pick and choose one or two to show you how the waste identification and determination process works. And then we'll go ahead and move on here to the land disposal restrictions requirements. You have a removal action that's involving the following materials, determine if there are hazardous waste under RCRA. First one is used oil located in tanks. Used oil is a solid waste, but EPA has not listed it as a used oil as a hazardous waste. So if the used oil is recycled, for example, it's going to be sent to some company who recycles it, or they're going to burn it, recycle it by reformulating it into a fuel for energy recovery. There's a separate regulatory program that addresses that. And the federal regulations are 40 CFR 279. So used oil, in general, is not a hazardous waste. The only time it can be is if it has chlorinated solvents that have been mixed with it. And there is a limit. If you have more than 4,000 parts per million of chlorinated solvents or halogenated chemicals in your used oil mixture, then that will require it to be managed as a hazardous waste, actually a listed hazardous waste, instead of used oil. Second scenario is pipe insulation containing friable asbestos. Asbestos is not identified as a listed hazardous waste under RCRA. Neither is asbestos identified by any of the characteristics of RCRA. So asbestos is not a RCRA hazardous waste, but as most of you know, it is subject. There are disposal standards established under the Clean Air Act, National Emission Standards for Hazardous Air Pollutants, 40 CFR Part 61. With respect to the management of those materials containing friable asbestos. States also have regulations as well. Let's skip down one. Let's look at several drums containing used methylene chloride solvents. Okay, methylene chloride is a listed hazardous waste. Okay, so if you had several drums containing used methylene chloride and you were disposing of it, you would look at the listed hazardous waste, specifically waste from non-specific sources, and you'll see there's FOO1, FOO2, methylene chlorides identified on there. So that would be an example of a listed hazardous waste. Say you encounter several drums of paint thinner that you're throwing away. Well, paint thinner is derived from mineral spirits, petroleum products. If you were to look at the listed hazardous waste, you'll see the EPA is not listed paint thinner or any of the components of paint thinner. So in order to determine whether it was a hazardous waste, you would see if the paint thinner exhibited the characteristics, any of the characteristics, the most likely one being ignitability, which it probably does. And so if it did exhibit the characteristic of ignitability, the spent paint thinner would have to be managed as a hazardous waste. So those are just some examples how we walk through it. In summary, with waste determination, again, first thing you should do, know what the material is, how it was produced, and what you're going to do with it. Then consult your regulations. And the process basically involves determining whether the waste meets the definition of a solid waste, and then once it meets the definition of a solid waste, you need to determine, has it been excluded from the definition of hazardous waste? If not, is it a listed hazardous waste? If not, does it exhibit any of the characteristics of a hazardous waste? In those unique cases where you're dealing with contaminated environmental media, be aware that's contained in policy, particularly if you know the source of the contamination contained a listed hazardous waste. That may be applicable in that case. Otherwise, the contaminated media would only be hazardous if it exhibits any of the characteristics. That's it for the waste determination module. I'm going to take a sip of my Coca-Cola here, and then we'll start the land disposal restrictions here. Okay, let's go ahead and get started on this one here, and we'll roll through this section. Turn to the next slide. Land disposal restrictions basics is the title of it. what's the purpose of the LDRs? The LDR program, the authority from it, came from the Hazardous Solid Waste Amendments of 1984. And essentially, Congress at this particular period of time was most concerned about the land disposal of hazardous waste. Based on the evidence of that time, that was considered the greatest risk to human health and the environment was improper disposal of hazardous waste in landfills. So in an effort to reduce that risk, they established a program known as Land Ban, or Land Disposal Restrictions Program. It was actually modeled off of what the state of California had been doing for a number of years. And basically, it prohibited certain hazardous waste from being placed into a land disposal unit, okay, unless they were properly treated to reduce the threat that these wastes would pose if placed in a landfill or other type of land disposal unit. Now, land disposal for purposes of the land ban program is broadly defined. It's basically where you're putting anything on the ground, or even if you're not putting on the ground, for example, if you were disposing of a waste in an old abandoned missile silo, that would be considered land disposal. And waste would be prohibited, hazardous waste would be prohibited from being placed in that silo unless they met applicable treatment standards. And we'll talk about what treatment standards are a little bit later. The important thing for you to understand is the implementation of land disposal restriction program doesn't occur at the ultimate disposal facility. It actually, the determination whether something subject to the land disposal program and is prohibited from being placed from land disposal begins where the waste initially is created, or what we refer to as the point of generation. So once you generate a hazardous waste, okay, you'll at that point have to determine whether it's prohibited from land disposal. And we refer to this as the LDRs attaching to the hazardous waste at the point of generation. Now, the major regulations, I flip to the next slide, implementing the land disposal restrictions are identified there in your slide. What we're going to focus on is determination of treatment standards, because this is really the most critical issue that you all will encounter. How do you determine whether something, what a LDR treatment standard is to the hazardous waste that you're dealing with? So that's going to be the focus of this, you know, for the next 15 minutes on this seminar. The next slide just briefly identifies what are restricted waste. All hazardous wastes are subject to the land disposal program currently. Their EPA was given authorities to delay the effective date. Certain waste would be hazardous waste would be subject to land disposal restrictions by Congress, but these delays were only effective for 2 years, and all of them have subsequently passed. So essentially any hazardous waste that you generate out there is going to be subject to the LDR program. What you have to be concerned with is it prohibited from land disposal or can it be placed in a landfill? And that's where the treatment standards become critical. The next slide is where we talk about treatment standards, where we'll discuss it in some depth. As the generator, you have to determine whether the waste must be treated before it can be land disposed. A treatment standard is defined by Congress in the statute as any methods or means that reduces the volume, toxicity, mobility of toxic constituents in the waste, makes it safer for land disposal. EPA establishes treatment standards for hazardous waste based on identification of what the best demonstrated available technology is for that waste. And they express those treatment standards in several manners. The standards are actually found in 40 CFR Part 268, Subpart D. If you were to look at the treatment standards, what you would see is that some of these standards are expressed as a concentration of the regulated constituent, okay, in the treated waste. Sometimes the concentration will be expressed as milligrams per kilograms. In some cases, it will be milligrams per liter. If it's milligrams per liter, then the TCLP test, which we referred to earlier, is used to make that determination. In addition, a treatment standard can also be expressed by requiring a specific type of technology or treatment method be applied to the waste. So you'll have situations where EPA will refer to a particular technology or refer to a particular treatment method, and that's what you must use to achieve the treatment standard requirement under the LDR program, rather than treating it any way you want and then evaluating the concentration of the regulated constituent in the treated waste. When you're examining or trying to determine the applicable treatment standard to a hazardous waste, the first thing you need to do is determine what treatability group that hazardous waste fits into. And there are two treatability groups that EPA has established. One is wastewater and one is non-wastewater. And these treatability groups were established because they're based on the best demonstrated available technology that is applicable to that treatability group. Wastewater is defined as a waste that has 99% water, 1% total organic carbon, or 1% total organic solvents in it. Anything that is not a wastewater is defined as a, quote, non-wastewater. So it's an either-or thing. So if you have you're doing a cleanup at a plating shop and you're cleaning out the plating vat, and you have in this plating vat a chromium solution in it, that's probably not going to be considered a wastewater. It's going to be considered a non-wastewater. Okay. But it's important that once you know your hazardous waste, when you're going to determine the treatment standard for it, you figure out what treatability group it fits into. And that's based on the physical condition of the waste stream. Is it a wastewater or non-wastewater as it's defined? Now, in some cases, EPA has established treatment subcategories within those treatability groups. And these will just be unique subcategories for waste streams, like mercury containing waste, mercury characteristic waste. They'll have a number of subcategories depending on the level of mercury in it, and EPA has established different treatment methods or treatability standards, again, for those subcategories of mercury containing hazardous wastes. So it's another step you have to walk through in terms of determining the applicable treatment standard. Again, you know what the hazardous waste is, you determine what treatability group it falls into, and you may also have to be aware that a treatment subcategory exists within that treatability group. You need to look for that and determine whether the waste stream fits into that, because it may have a different treatment standard as a result. Again, the treatment standards are all found in 40 CFR Part 268 in the regulations. One of the things I caution OSCs and RPMs as well, but anybody who's working in this, is that remember the Part 268 regulations are implementing land disposal restrictions. You do not use those regulations to determine whether a waste is a hazardous waste or not. Something's a hazardous waste by virtue of the regulations in Part 261. So that means a waste stream's a hazardous waste because it's listed or exhibits a characteristic. The LDRs only apply to those wastes that you previously defined as hazardous waste. So if you don't have a hazardous waste, the LDRs aren't applicable. Now, the next slide on treatment standards, the first bullet you'll see there is something called universal treatment standards. What this means simply is that when EPA, if you look at all the waste streams that are identified as hazardous waste, the FKs, P and U's, and the characteristic waste, what you'll notice is that there are chemicals like benzene. Benzene can be identified in wastes that are listed hazardous waste, for example, FOO5. It can be identified as a U waste. It can be identified as a characteristic waste, D0118. way back when in the 90s, each of these different waste streams, even though it had benzene with the regulated constituent in it, it might have had a different treatment standard. The agency took a big effort to consolidate all those treatment standards, and in general, if benzene's in either, you know, FO5 or benzene's in U whatever, or if it's in D0118, if the treatability group is a non-wastewater, it will have the same treatment standard. And that's the idea behind this universal treatment standards, is that for all the chemicals that are found and listed in characteristic hazardous waste, if made an attempt to consolidate and have the same treatment standard for that chemical, regardless of whether the chemical was found in a listed hazardous waste or in a characteristic waste. But that's real briefly kind of the idea behind the universal treatment standards. Now, where this becomes really important to you is with respect to some of the treatment standards for characteristic hazardous wastes. So the characteristic hazardous wastes are the D wastes. So if you had, for example, a waste stream which was characteristic for chromium, and it's characteristic of toxicity for chromium, if you were to look at the treatment standard for it, you would have to treat the chromium to a certain level. Again, let's assume it's a non-wastewater. But then you're going to see something where it refers in the treatment standard. It's going to say also comply with 268.48. And what this requirement is that in addition to treating for the chromium, you need to treat for any underlying hazardous constituent, or UHC. Question becomes, well, what's the treatment standard for any of the underlying hazardous constituents? Well, I guess the first question is, what's an underlying hazard constituent? That would be any other chemical or heavy metal that could be found in that, that's reasonably found in that waste, that exceeds its universal treatment standard. So in the example I just gave you, if you had a waste stream that exhibited a characteristic of toxicity for chromium, but say it also had lead in it, and let's say it also had methylene chloride in it, then you would need to determine if the methylene chloride and lead, which would be identified as underlying hazardous constituents, are above their universal treatment standards. If they were, then those constituents would also have to be treated again to meet the treatment standard requirements, and so that the waste ultimately would be allowed to be disposed of in a landfill or land disposal unit. So that's kind of a quick summary of explanation what the universal treatment standards are and how they come into play with respect to identifying treatment standards for characteristic hazardous wastes. EPA has also established what we call alternative treatment standards for lab packs, hazardous debris, and contaminated soils. These came about as a result of cleanup activities. And I assume the majority of you know what a lab pack is, but if you're dealing with cleaning up a laboratory, and lab pack simply is where you take smaller containers, like smaller volumes of chemicals in a laboratory, and you pack them in a larger drum, and then you ship it off for disposal. And you could, in theory, have hundreds of chemicals, which would have all the own unique individual treatment standards, but rather what's easier is EPA has established two distinct treatment standards, alternative treatment standards for different types of lab packs, and it makes it easier just to comply with the LDRs by availing yourself to using those. Hazardous debris is basically things like concrete, foundations, bricks, things like that that have become contaminated with hazardous waste somehow or some way. And again, the question becomes, well, how do I, am I going to have to incinerate concrete? Say, for example, you have a secondary containment unit which held a tank, and the tank leaked. So the top 1 or 2 inches of the concrete are impregnated by a solvent, a listed hazardous waste solvent. You go to clean up the site, so you remove the tank, you decon the tank and get it out, and you have the secondary containment unit. By virtue of the fact that it released the hazardous waste to it, you're told that you have to manage the secondary containment, the concrete, as a hazardous waste. Well, that'd be rather expensive to try to incinerate all that concrete. So there is an alternative treatment standard for hazardous debris that you could avail yourself to, which would involve a specific technology such as pressure washer rinsing or another applicable technology that once you apply it to it, there may be a subsequent test to determine the efficacy or the how clean is clean you got the concrete. Then that remaining concrete that's been removed of that methylene chloride or the solvent that was spilled onto it would no longer be considered a hazardous waste, and you could dispose of it as in construction and debris material instead. So the hazardous debris alternative treatment standards are, again, is an important tool to use where you have that type of you encounter that type of waste stream. The final one is contaminated soils, and this is, again, only applicable to those contaminated soils that are defined as hazardous waste. And simply put, is it's an alternative treatment standard that doesn't require you to meet the stringent treatment standard based on demonstrated available technology, but rather the agency says you need to reduce the maximum, the concentration of the constituent by 90%, okay, topped, but you don't have to go below 10 times the universal treatment standard. So it's a less stringent treatment standard for contaminated soils than which would otherwise apply if that alternative treatment standard didn't exist. Okay, the next slide is just a recap of, again, the process by how you go about determining treatment standards. And it first starts with proper identification of whether the waste is a RCRA hazardous waste. So that's the first step. You determine whether it's a RCRA hazardous waste, and you identify what the applicable RCRA hazardous waste code is, D001, FO6, KO37, whatever. Then you turn to the regulations of 40 CFR Part 268, where the land disposal restriction regulations are. You look specifically at 268.40, and you identify what the treatability group is, wastewater, non-wastewater. Then you look to see if there's a subcategory based, again, on the physical criteria of the waste, physical description of the waste, and whether an alternative treatment standard exists. And then if you have a waste stream that is identified as FO1 through FO5 or FO39, you determine what are the constituents in the waste that are actually regulated, that are actually present in the waste that are going to require treatment. If you have a characteristic hazardous waste, because you not only need to treat the waste for the characteristic, you also have to treat for any underlying hazardous constituents, you need to make a determination if any underlying hazardous constituents exist in the waste, and if so, if they're above the universal treatment standards, then they need to be treated to the universal treatment standards as well. So that's the basic process by which we go through there. The next slide is just a more detailed discussion on the alternative treatment standards for contaminated soil. As I mentioned before, it gives you more flexibility for meeting LDR treatment standards rather than having to meet a performance standard that was established by EPA for an industrial hazardous waste. And again, the standard simply requires that the concentration of hazardous constituents that are found in the soil be reduced by 90%, but the treatment doesn't have to go below 10 times the universal treatment standard. Okay. The next slide just simply says you have to measure this 90% reduction consistent with whatever the measuring requirement is for, and you know, the specific constituent under consideration under the universal treatment standards. One of the good things that the alternative treatment standards for contaminated soil did is prior to that, a lot of times what cleanup folks had to do is they had to actually go through and obtain a treatability variance. While it's not, they've expedited the process over the past decade, it used to be very time-consuming and involved, and it dissuaded folks from pursuing that option. Now with the alternative treatment standards for contaminated soil, there's no need to go through that treatability variance petitioning process. The next slide are just some of the statutory prohibitions that have been incorporated into the regulations against dilution and storage. Simply put, you're not allowed to invoke a treatment method to achieve the treatment standards that simply involves dilution. So you have to be wary of that. This has been enforced a couple of times, but that's been in industrial situations where, you know, folks were claiming they were treating hazardous waste, but in fact, upon further examination, they were simply diluting it in order to achieve the LDR treatment standard. The other thing you may encounter sometimes is the storage prohibition. There is a statutory requirement, and it's in the regulations as well, where you're not allowed to store hazardous waste that's subject to the land ban for extremely long periods of time as a means of avoiding complying with the land ban treatment standards. So be aware of that as well. The final thing here are just variances and petitions from the LDR treatment standards. The only ones that I want to talk about is a treatability variance. Real quick, and this is not for soils, but you may have unique waste streams where if you identify the treatment standards, they're just too stringent for that particular mixture or unique situation where you have a Superfund site and the waste that you're dealing, the hazardous waste you're dealing with, is not at all like the type of hazardous waste EPA studied when they established the best demonstrated available technology and set the treatment standard based on the performance of that BDAT. And so if you have a unique situation, like you have a unique mixture of hazardous wastes or sediments, for example, that are contaminated and have to be managed as hazardous waste, then you might want to avail yourself to this treatability variance. And this, again, is a case where you basically prepare a petition, more or less, the RCRA division, where you show that the waste stream is physically and chemically different from the waste stream upon which EPA established the treatment standards, the industrial waste stream. And this can result in a different treatment standard, usually, obviously, a less stringent treatment standard, which you can avail yourself to. The next slide just simply states that the treatability variance has been delegated to the regional offices. It used to all be done at headquarters. There's no public comment required for it, but if you're going to go this route, you have to be aware that it's going to need to be included in your administrative record, and can be a standalone document or of its own self, or could be included in an action memo or record of decision. The final slide here, or the next slide I have, is a couple of quick examples. I'll briefly run through those and just kind of show you, try to show you how we would go about determining the LDR treatment standards. Let's say you have, first one would be several drums of spent solvent mixture containing benzene and toluene, containing more than 10% of each chemical. What this indicates to me is that we have a listed hazardous waste. It would be F005, and the two regulated constituents in it are benzene and toluene. So what I would do is I've identified it as a RCRA hazardous waste F005. Now I turn to Part 268 240. And if you hear me flipping pages here, it's because I have my beat up old CFR here, which I'm looking through to pull the numbers out. Okay. Hopefully I'll find it here. And then in this case, I found the waste code. Okay, I'm looking at the treatment standards for hazardous waste, and I found the waste code, okay, the table where FO5 is listed in it. Now, looking at the table, my two constituents of concern are toluene and benzene. As I indicated earlier, I need to determine whether or not I'm dealing with a wastewater. What treatability group does this spent several drums of spent solvent mixture containing those constituents fall into, wastewaters and non-wastewaters? Well, we don't have the information there, but I'll assume that they're non-wastewaters, okay, because they're fairly concentrated. If they were spent solvents, I would not assume at this point that they're wastewaters. And looking at it with benzene, I would find out that the treatment standard for a non-wastewater F005 is 10 milligrams per liter. Okay, so that waste stream, before it could be disposed of, would have to have less than 10 milligrams per liter benzene in it. The treatment standard for toluene is also 10 as well. And in general, what this would require is that this waste be incinerated or be managed in a boiler industrial furnace, but some sort of combustion technology, and typically would be used to meet the treatment standard as prescribed by the LDRs. Now, the second example is where we're doing cleanup from an electroplating vat that contains cyanide, chromium, and silver. And this is just an example where the waste is, we would determine first that it's a hazardous waste by virtue of the chromium. The chromium exceeds the characteristic of toxicity level, regulatory level. So it's going to be a hazardous waste by virtue of the chromium. So the chromium constituent won't be treated. But it also contains silver in it, and silver would be considered an underlying hazardous constituent. So we'd need to determine whether the silver exceeds its universal treatment standard or not in order to determine whether the silver also requires treatment in this waste as well. So those are two examples of how we go about determining applicable treatment standards under the LDR program. Again, I reiterate, the first step is to determine whether it's a hazardous waste or not. If it's not a hazardous waste, the LDR regulations don't apply to it. Okay? All right, now we have our last module, which are common RCRA requirements for managing hazardous waste on-site and off-site. This just briefly discusses some typical RCRA requirements for the different management methods used by OSCs to handle hazardous waste on-site, and what the when you're transporting or shipping hazardous waste off-site, what are the RCRA regulations that would apply? So if you turn to the next page, you'll see a listing there. The typical management methods employed by OSCs during removal actions include storing or accumulating hazardous waste in containers or placing them in what we call a temporary unit, managing, usually it's contaminated media, in an area of contamination. Corrective action management units are generally only employed at remedial actions. There may be one or two of you guys who've encountered a CAMU in a removal action, but that's more of a remedial, management method. Staging piles, and then with groundwater pump and treat or groundwater programs, there's some LDR policies and requirements that come into play with reinjection of the groundwater. Talk about that real briefly. And then if you had a RCRA, if you're at a facility that was regulated under RCRA as a treatment, storage, and disposal facility, and say they had an impoundment or maybe even a tank unit, the unit may be subject to RCRA closure. And if it was a land disposal unit or during closure, you were going to create a land disposal unit as a result of it, post-closure requirements may apply to that area. And so I'll briefly kind of just allude to those in a few minutes as we walk through all these different topics. And with respect to off-site applicable requirements, we'll look at what are your pre-transport requirements are before you package and label containers. I'll mention the manifest, the use of EPA ID numbers, LDR tracking requirements, and then everybody's favorite, especially OSCs, biennial reports. We'll get to that. Let's look at containers real quick. That's I flip to the next slide. The containers is actually defined. There's a term is a defined term under RCRA. And a container is a unit that's portable. That's how you distinguish it from a tank, is that it's portable. But a container can include, obviously, the drum, a tote, and it can also include even something like a tanker car. These can all be considered containers as long as it's portable. The containers, RCRA requirements simply state that if you're going to place hazardous waste in containers, it has to be in good condition, compatible, closed during storage, and provided it was secondary containment to contain any spills from it. If you have ignitable, reactive, or incompatible waste, there are some special management regulations so they don't, with respect to those particular waste streams. Obviously, if you have a spill or leak into the containment area, the spill has to be addressed as soon as possible, immediately. And if you have residues in those containers, like if, for example, you had a drum that held hazardous waste, maybe you consolidated, emptied it, put that in another drum. Two things. There is an empty container rule under RCRA, which is found in 261.6, and that defines when a container is empty, i.e., what that means is any residue, hazardous waste residue left in the container is no longer subject to RCRA regulation. You might hear this referred to as the one-inch rule for regular hazardous waste. If it was an acutely hazardous waste, it's a requirement that the container or inner liner have to be triple rinsed or cleaned via an appropriate method before, again, any remaining residue is not regulated under RCRA. But in addition to containers, if you have secondary containment systems, liners, or bases that were used, you will have to decontaminate them and remove them properly at closure as well. A temporary unit is a defined term under RCRA. It was actually created by the RCRA Corrective Action Regulations, and it essentially is a tank or container that's being used to manage remediation waste. It typically avails itself, and where it comes into play is the RCRA tank system regulations. If you had a hazardous waste tank system that was regulated under RCRA, there were some very stringent requirements for it. Leak detection, monitoring, secondary containment, a number of different other requirements that are involved, integrity assessments, what have you. Because the idea behind a temporary unit is they were being built to accommodate a remedial effort, or in this case, a removal effort, the temporary unit regulations allow alternative standards to the more stringent requirements it would be for a permanent hazardous waste tank system. And so they are typically employed as ARRs during removal and remedial actions. The only other thing that comes into play is that there is a time limit with respect to its operation, 1 year, I think, and it could be renewed for another year. But that's, again, something that comes into play and is a typical means of managing RCRA hazardous waste on site without having to comply with the hazardous waste tank system requirements that are found subpart J, part 40 CFR 264. The next slide is area contamination concept, this really, the idea, this came about, again, back in the 1988-1990 time frame, and it was a direct result of the HISWA requirements regarding implementation of land disposal restrictions and what we also refer to as the minimum technological requirements for land disposal units, which are liners, leachate collection systems, groundwater monitoring. If you had a site which had a release of hazardous substances that contaminated soil, you know, you say you had a ditch that you can became contaminated because guys dumped solvents out the back door, okay, or other areas of the facility where you had discrete contaminated areas associated with a release. And you determine that the contaminated media is a hazardous waste under RCRA. It's a hazardous waste under RCRA. The area contamination concept is important consideration simply because it allows you to move waste, you know, that contaminated media within the area of contamination. So you can pick it up, place it one place, move it around, consolidate it within that single AOC, and you will not trigger compliance with the land disposal restrictions requirements or any of the minimum technological requirements. Basically, the AOC, the way it evaluates or identifies that area, that footprint that's been contaminated, is they consider that to be akin to a landfill. And so if you move the waste around there, or you move the contaminated media around there, okay, but you don't go outside the boundaries, and you don't pick it up, treat it, then try to put it back down in the thing, then what they're basically saying is you're not going to have to trigger compliance with these land liners and leachate collection removal systems or the LDR treatment standards. So it's an important concept where you're dealing with, different, you know, areas at a site where there's, you know, contaminated soil exists. And you're trying to stage or avail yourself your removal action to properly manage it in such a way that you don't trigger these, you know, LDR minimum technological requirements. Let's go to the next one. The corrective action management unit. This is different. This was just a special type of land-based unit that EPA created regulations for the management of remediation waste. There are different types of CAMOs. You can have a disposal CAMO, a treatment CAMO, a storage CAMO. The corrective action management units can be actually located in a contaminated area already, or they could be sited in an area that's not contaminated. As well. These are typically, again, employed in remedial actions where you have large volumes of hazardous waste or hazardous remediation waste where it's cost prohibitive to send that waste off-site for disposal. And so it's better to, you know, the decisions made to contain it or and dispose of it on-site. What the CAMOs provide is they provide flexibility to the typical hazardous waste landfill design and operation standards. And so that's where their big advantage is. They provide some flexibility to what would otherwise apply to a commercial hazardous waste land disposal unit. The next slide, one of the things that initially EPA had wanted to accomplish by using CAMOs is they had hoped to avoid compliance with the LDR requirements. So the idea, the thought process back in the mid-90s was, well, we'll design or we'll define an area as a CAMO, and any of the remediation waste that's placed in it won't have to meet LDR treatment standards or minimum technological requirements. Well, they got sued on that, and they lost. And so as a result, the compromise was that CAMOs, waste that go into CAMOs are land disposal, so hazardous waste must meet the LDR treatment standards, but the compromise was that you only had to treat what was defined as principal hazardous constituents, which is basically the worst thing that requires the most stringent level of treatment in the waste before it's placed in a disposal CAMO. And so even though you designate an area as a CAMU, any hazardous remediation waste that goes in it, just be aware of it, still would have to meet LDR treatment standards for the principal hazardous constituents. A CAMU will have to be designated in your action memo or your record of decision if you choose to use one on it. Briefly, some of the differences between CAMUs and AOCs. Wastes may be treated ex situ and placed in a CAMU. You can't do that with an AOC. If you do treat ex situ, bring it up out of the ground, treat it before it can go back into the AOC, it's going to have to meet the LDR treatment standards. As I mentioned before, a CAMU can be located in an uncontaminated area. Obviously, an area of contamination, by definition, is not an uncontaminated area. Remediation, hazardous waste remediation waste, can be consolidated in CAMUs from any area of the site that's not contiguously contaminated. With AOCs, you can only consolidate the material within the AOC. So you can't take contaminated soil from one AOC and move it into another AOC. That's an important distinction to be aware of. Okay, next slide is staging pile. This was a new remediation unit, hazardous remediation unit was created back in the late 90s, and essentially what it is it's a waste pile light under RCRA. You can manage hazardous wastes in a staging pile, and they aren't subject, even if though they're built on the ground, they're not subject to the LDRs, land disposal restrictions, or minimum technological requirements. However, the staging pile can only be used for, you know, storage, some physical type of operation, such as mixing, sizing, or blending. But you cannot treat in a staging pile. The design requirements for a staging pile provide a lot of flexibility versus having to meet much more stringent requirements that would be required for a typical hazardous waste pile. I mentioned groundwater cleanups. Most of you guys don't really get into pump and treat programs during the removal process, I assume, but there is a policy. In some cases, groundwater, as I mentioned, as a contaminated media, can be considered to be regulated under RCRA. And the long story or short story here is simply is that if you have a pump and treat program and you're bringing the contaminated groundwater above surface to treat it and then reinject it, the reinjection would typically is defined as land disposal. And application of the LDR requirements would say, well, you have to meet treatment standard before you can put it back in the ground. Obviously, Congress realized that this would be problematic with an ongoing pump and treat as a part of a long-term restoration effort for groundwater. So they provided an exclusion or an exemption from the LDR treatment standards for pump and treat operations as long as they're subject to, they're authorized under the RCRA Corrective Action Program or they're being implemented under CERCLA authorities, removal and remedial response. This also means that if you're doing some sort of enhanced in situ bioremediation where you're adding nutrients or ingredients into injection wells to facilitate the cleanup of the groundwater, and the groundwater is considered hazardous waste, and you're reinjecting it, you're not going to get into issues where you have to comply with LDR treatment standards. So that's the essence of that particular requirement that was stipulated by, originally established by Section 3020 of RCRA, the statute, but then further explained in EPA policies. Okay, so if you go to the next slide, just talks a little bit more about the in situ process and how that's also, that would be exempted as well if that's part of the groundwater pump and treat program or restoration effort. I mentioned closure, RCRA closure, and post-closure care requirements. Okay, the only thing, again, I want to cite, make make you all aware of is if you do have a facility where you're doing a removal action, and it was a permitted facility under RCRA, it was a TSDF, Treatment, Storage, and Disposal Facility, that had a permit, or maybe it operated under interim status at one time. Sometimes the states may tell you that certain units, like tanks, or if they had a container storage area, or they had a surface impoundment where they did wastewater treatment, was they had a permit or they had interim status to operate those units under RCRA at one time. And consideration here is that under RCRA, those units are subject to closure. Closure is an applicable requirement to those units. And so RCRA has established a whole set of requirements for how you go about closing those things and even post-closure obligations if you close them such that waste remains in place. Bear in mind that these are applicable requirements in some cases, and so you will have to address them if you run into sites that are like that. So that's the point I want to make there. Okay, finally, we have the off-site management of hazardous waste, and we'll just briefly go through this. And our timing's good because I'm here talking to you in Arlington, Virginia, and we have a big old thunderstorm heading this way, so I'm sure my power is going to go out here in a few minutes. The first thing it will be is the RCRA pre-transport regulations. If we turn to the next, what those basically are is before you ship containers off-site drums, you'll have to comply with a number of DOT, Department of Transportation regulations with respect to labeling, marking the container. And these are all identified in 40 CFR 262 in the generator regulations. In addition, when the waste are sent off, if it's hazardous waste, you have to comply with the specific hazardous waste manifest. And this is just a tracking form, shipping paper, unique to RCRA program that tracks the waste from its original generator through the transporter to the ultimate treatment, storage, and disposal facility. You need an EPA ID number as a generator, if the site does not already have one, to place on the hazardous waste manifest. Okay, and the transporter, as well as the TSDF, will also have to have an EPA ID number as well. The waste, because of the LDR program, the first shipment of that waste outside to the selected disposal facility will also have to have an LDR tracking form. A notice or a certification that the waste meets the treatment standards. This is just information to provide the subsequent handler this regulatory status under the LDR program of the waste that they're receiving or managing. Is it prohibited from land disposal, or does it already meet the treatment standards? Depending on where you're sending the waste, you'll have different scenarios, different tracking obligations. These are found in 40 CFR 268.7. And then finally, but not least, I mention this because headquarters always discusses this with us when they talk to me about the training that we do with OSCs and RPMs. They go, are you mentioning the applicability of biennial reports to these guys? Okay, so I'm sure there's a frown out there to some of the folks listening to me, or they're just like, what's a biennial report? I've never filled one out, and I'm not going to fill one out. But anyways, under RCRA, if you are a large quantity generator, so you generate more than 1,000 kilograms per calendar month, so this would be a large removal action or large remedial action where you're sending waste off-site, that much waste off-site in a calendar month. You are required, because this is off-site shipment, the interpretation is this is an applicable requirement, and what that means is that you have to prepare a biennial report the following year that discusses your hazardous waste generating activity at that site because you were a large quantity generator. The biennial reports, EPA requires, and some states require annual reporting. It's a form you fill out that documents the amount of waste generated, how it was managed, and stuff. It's used for tracking. It's also used for management, generating statistics on the management of the overall program. And some states also assign a fee to it based on the amount that you're generating. It's how they help fund their programs in the states. So that's just a brief discussion of the biennial report. Again, just my experience in teaching, I know some folks, it's been a little bit of a controversy there, but I've only seen it one time in a record of decision actually identified as an applicable requirement. But again, it's something that's triggered based on you being a hazardous, large quantity hazardous waste generator. And it requires reporting of your hazardous waste activities the following year. And I know it's problematic for OSCs because a lot of times you guys are done and gone. And so, you know, you're not, there's no follow-up there. But again, just something I want to make you aware of. Okay, Gene, I think that's it. Well, we got 5 minutes here. I got through all of that.
Excellent job. We do have a few minutes. So I congratulate you on getting through all that content on time. We're going to take just a few minutes to take some questions from our audience members. For those of you that are streaming the audio online, again, there's a question mark icon that's located at the top of your slides. If you have questions you'd like to type up or comments, you may certainly do so. We want to make sure your pop-up blockers are disabled or that it's not hidden behind your web browser window, because it'll be open up in a new window where you can type up your questions or comments. I'm going to start with those individuals, though, on the phone lines. If there are questions coming in from participants on the phone, you can take yourself off of mute. You may need to hit #6 to unmute your line, and then feel free to ask Dave a question directly. Okay. Well, I do have a question that came in online, and this is a pretty simple one. I think you can handle this one. But we had this question come in asking, what's the acronym OSC stand for?
On-scene coordinator.
Excellent. Thank you.
I was going to say, you know, don't fire away all at once with that question.
Not a problem. And again, if you're participating remotely, you can continue to type up your questions or comments. We'll still wait a few minutes to see if anybody who's streaming audio has a question or comment for Dave. If you're on the phone lines, by all means, feel free to unmute and go ahead and interrupt us and let us know that you're there and you have a question. Again, I don't see anything else coming in online. Did you have any closing statements or comments that you wanted to make, Dave, while we're waiting to see if any other questions come in?
No, I don't. I appreciate those of you who, you know, I hope you got something out of it. It's a little bit different trying to talk through this without the normal, you know, face-to-face interaction that I'm kind of used to with training. But yeah, good luck with it. I'm sure if you got Gene, you get any questions that should come in, if you have my email, if you want to forward them to me, I'd be happy to respond to people on that. I have no problem doing that.
All right, great. Well, since I don't see any questions coming in, what I'll do is go through our closing procedures, and one of those comments is exactly what you just brought up. If by any chance any of our participants today have a question or comment that they'd like to address or have Dave answer later on, you'll find his contact information on the seminar homepage. You can also certainly email me directly, and I'll be happy to forward that on to our instructor so that he can follow up with you later on. If there aren't any questions, and I'm just going to do a going once, going twice, going three times. Okay, with a few minutes to spare, then we will close out today's session. I'm going to direct everyone to the final slide in your package, which should be slide number 51. On that final slide, you'll find two very important links. One is a link to the resources page where you can download today's PowerPoint presentation, but also look at a collection of other resources related to our topic. The other link you'll see on slide number 51 is a short feedback form, and we would ask that you take just a minute or two to fill out feedback and let us know what you thought of today's session. If you're looking to get credit for your participation today, when you fill out that feedback form, you can check a box on the form to actually have a confirmation message sent to you for your records. We don't necessarily issue credit, but if you're looking for CEUs or PDHs, you might have more luck in getting credit for participating with that confirmation message, which will verify that you did submit feedback for the session at the end. If you're not sitting at a computer with internet access, those links are also accessible at the bottom of the seminar homepage, so you can certainly go back and look at the resources and submit feedback at a later time. Also, if you shared the line, which it looks like a number of us did, and we had about 70 people total across the U.S. who joined us today, if you shared the computer with a number of other participants, when you fill out the feedback form, there'll be a box or a link that'll pop up once you've submitted feedback to allow someone else to come onto that computer and submit their own feedback form. So each individual participant can actually get their own confirmation message, even though you all participated under one registration. With that, I don't have any other closing comments or reminders other than that you should get an email from me in about 1 to 2 weeks with the link to replay the recording of this session, which you are welcome to also forward to any colleagues that you think will find it useful. With that, I want to thank our instructor from Tetra Tech for joining us today, as well as the OSC Readiness Conference Committee for putting together this panel presentation, which will continue on throughout the summer here on CLUIN. So if you're interested in more topics like this, please take a look at the CLUIN training calendar and look for the other sessions that have been scheduled as part of the OSC Readiness Present series. I want to thank again all of our participants who joined us across the U.S. for today's session and hope that you found it to be a valuable expenditure of your time. With that, I'm going to close out the phone lines and hope you all have a good rest of the day.